We have still some people coming. Thank you very much for coming. Welcome. Good evening. I'm very, very happy to see you here this evening. This is a lecture which is entitled Central Eastern Europe, the European Union and the United States. Yeah, but it seems it will be mostly about Central Europe, I hear now. But anyhow, there will be time to ask questions about European Union and United States as well. My name is Irena Grudzińska-Gross, and this is the Institute for Human Sciences at Boston University. And our speaker today is Martin Butora. Let me say at the beginning that I'm very, very happy to have Martin Butora speaking here, that I know him for quite a while. I have been following his work for many years, and we are particularly privileged to have him here. He's a Slovak sociologist, writer, university professor, and diplomat. From 1999 to 2003, he served as Slovakia's ambassador to the United States. And in 2004, he ran as an independent candidate for president of Slovakia with quite a wonderful program and with a very respectable showing, although he's not a president of Slovakia, and this is why we are lucky to have him here with us today.
Thank you for this interpretation.
The most important thing about Martin Butora, one of the most important things, is that he was a dissident before 1989, that he co-founded a Public Against Violence movement, that from 1990 until 1992, he served as the advisor to President Václav Havel for human rights issues, and the director of the Section for Human Rights in the Office of the President of Czechoslovakia. He stopped doing that when the Velvet Revolution transformed itself into Velvet Divorce and Czechoslovakia split into two countries. He is, for me and for many other people, a model of public intellectual. Among his many former activities, one should mention newspaper and magazine editorship. He's author of several books, including two sociological monographs and several studies and articles in volumes and in professional journals. He writes and participates in public life in Slovakia and in East Central Europe. And he's the honorary president of an Institute for Public Affairs and program director of European Integration and Transatlantic Relations Program in Bratislava. He's a very astute political analyst, and we are very privileged to have him here this evening. And also, we are very lucky that moderating the discussion is Dr. Chandler Rosenberger, lecturer in international relations and fellow of the Center for International Relations at Boston University. His area of specialty are Czech and Slovak dissident movements. And from 1992 until 1994, he covered the collapse of Czechoslovakia and the war in Yugoslavia as a fellow of the Institute for Current World Affairs. He's currently at work on the biography of former Czech president and dissident, before that, Václav Havel, and playwright, one should add. What is very interesting is that he and our speaker know each other for 16 years. They first met in 1990 in Bratislava, and this is also in 1990s when I met with Martin Butora. Dr. Rosenberger was lecturing at that time in philosophy at the Slovak Academy and working with an educational foundation to help reform universities after the fall of communism. He will be moderating our discussion. Ambassador Butora will speak for approximately 30, 40 minutes, and then we'll have comments and then a discussion. It will, the whole official part will last for, as usual, for an hour and a half, and then we are going to have a reception which is meant to offer another possibility for conversation and a continuous discussion. So thank you very much, and please, Martin Butora.
Irenka, thank you so much for such a very generous introduction. And I'm really glad to be here. I see some faces in the audience which I happen to know. Let it be the members of the experienced generation. I'm not saying elder generation, or let it be some young new friends. So the more I hope that we will have a nice discussion. I was just talking to Chandler about this old sentence from the Communist Manifesto, which was about that the specter of communism is haunting Europe. So in Europe, there is a feeling that the specter of populism is now haunting Europe. And if you look at the articles, at the studies, at the journals, if you follow the public debates, so you see that there are some concerns with this phenomenon, and sometimes it reminds that situation which was described there. Specter, in Communist Manifesto, it was obviously specter of communism. Now the specter of populism. Yes, that's. So I will try this evening to place these developments in different contexts and to discuss them in within different frameworks. I'd like to start with a period that about 10 years ago when Farid Zakaria published his influential article on the rise of illiberal democracies. At the time, he could easily find illustrations for his thesis, because they were indeed many countries where the elections might be free and fair, but they used in some cases to bring to the power politicians who didn't sufficiently respect the rule of law, division of power, and the protection of basic liberties. Countries which, according to Zakaria, in which democracy is flourishing, constitutional liberalism is not. What Zakaria was criticized at the time was the elections, actually. He said that elections are an important virtue of democracy, but they are not the only virtue. Governments should be judged by yardsticks related to constitutional liberalism as well. But Zakaria, as you know, was not alone. In the same year, Samuel Huntington published his ideas on the future of the third wave democracies, which frequently tended to be only procedural or delegative democracies, or even rare pseudo-democracies or semi-democracies. And 10 years ago, there was a whole bulk of literature on the so-called electoral democracies. There were many names for it, standing as an opposing pole to genuine liberal democracies. Larry Diamond, for instance, pointed at increasing shallowness of democratization in the latter part of the third wave. Electoral democracies, he wrote, have governments resulting from reasonably free and fair elections, but they lack many of these other safeguards for rights and liberties that exist in liberal democracies. And even if scholars like Mary Kaldor and Ivan Vejvoda, who at that time were chairing a group which was deliberating about the fate of democracy in Central Eastern Europe, and even if they were pointing at the certain shallowness and at the fact that while in those countries the basic rules of democracy can be preserved, at the same time those democracies are in a substantive sense, it means as for democratic political culture, rather weak, they were even pondering about a special sui generis post-communist model. Probably no one would have imagined that after a decade, this region, now a part of the European Union, will raise concerns about its devotion to democratic spirit. However, this is precisely what many advocates of liberal constitutionalism are watching right now. Political populism in Central Eastern Europe is on the rise. Traditional divisions between center-left and center-right parties grow increasingly blurred, says Ivan Krastev. The liberal parties, which were the main political actors during the transition period, are now facing increasingly strong competition from nationalists, socialists, and conservative traditionalists. And over the last 2 years, elections, says Krastev, in at least 5 countries in the region have demonstrated that the political parties which stand behind the liberal consensus of the transition period, market economy, protection of human rights, pro-Western orientation in foreign affairs, are no longer in a dominant or even comfortable position. In Slovakia, the coalition government led by the Prime Minister Zurinda, which included also, and this was very important, the representatives of domestic Hungarian minority, and was known for launching and actually quite successfully completing some important and far-reaching reforms, was replaced by a strange coalition of social democrats and national populists. And even if Mr. Fico, the current prime minister, has publicly calming down some of his supporters, denying that he wants to make a coalition of a Mečiar's movement for a democratic Slovakia. Mečiar was a semi-authoritarian politician known in Slovakia for its undemocratic practices in the 90s. So the coalition with this party, with the Slovak National Party, the name speaks for itself, and his party called Smer, or Direction. So even if he was denying it and he was suggesting that this is just a pure fiction of his opponents, we want to have an international respected cabinet, finally, that was precisely the coalition which he made. In Poland, a coalition of nationalists and conservatives has seized the power with the mission to create the new Fourth Republic, a decisive farewell to the whole post-communist past, which might part with some of the key liberal commitments of the last 15 years. In Hungary, the socialists managed to preserve power, but their chairman has been systematically hiding before the nation the seriousness of the economic problems of the Hungarian economy, as it was revealed by himself, actually. These are his own words. He and the others lied in the morning and lied in the evening, and he used even more dirty words than just this polite expression of what he and his government have been doing. Lying about the state of the economy to win re-election. The populist electoral strategies of both the ruling coalition and the flamboyant nationalistic opposition ultimately led to massive street protests and violence. And obviously the most important or most visible victim of these processes seems to be the public confidence in liberal democracy. Krastev adds to these three states also the Czech Republic, where the last electoral cycle produced a political deadlock in which the liberal or conservative liberal Civic Democratic Party finds its agenda frustrated by the joint opposition of social democrats and communists. Actually, just yesterday, the Czechs celebrated half a year without the government, which makes some commentators and economic analysts quite happy. And they are saying, look, economy is prospering, the kids are visiting schools, the factories are working, do we need any government at all? Do we need any government, you know, to pass to the parliament dozens of idiotic bits and acts and so on? We are doing quite well. I think it might sound as a humor, but in my eyes this is actually very problematic, because not only it blocks any reform, but it undermines the basis of democratic governments. This is the country simply which for half a year doesn't have a government. And finally, we could mention Bulgaria, a new member state as of January 1st next year, where the elections confirmed the demise of the center-right parties, which contributed most to the success of transition and to the EU entry, and where we also saw the birth of influential nationalist populist formations. And these 5 countries are not the only countries where we see some problematic developments. I could mention just 2 of them. like, for instance, incidents of homophobia in, for instance, Latvia, which led to a united front of nationalists from different conservative groups, or some of the rulings of conservative authorities in Slovenia, which raised concerns in the circles devoted and dedicated to liberal constitutionalism. Thus, paradoxically, the region in the world where liberal democracy made its most important strides over the last 15 years seems now ready to challenge some of its main principles. I happen to be a part of that project, which was led by Mary Keldor and Ivan Vejvoda, called Democratization in Central and East European Countries, and supported by European Commission, together with Martin Paloš, writing on the Czech Republic, Marcin Krul on Poland, András Bozóki on Hungary, Alina Mingiu PPD on Romania, and Ljubljana Kolarova on Bulgaria. I would guess all of those members have visited Boston at some point of time and maybe talked to the audiences like this, sharing their views on transition. And I remember well the atmosphere and the discussions which we had at that time. Is there really anything like a special sui generis post-communist model of democracy that is influenced on the one hand by the legacy of communism and at the same time by both the weaknesses and the strengths of Western democracy? Can we talk about, this was Mary Keldor's idea, about an emergent concept of European democratic space, as a way of consolidating democracy in Central and Eastern European countries and even reinvigorating democracy in Western Europe? During our meetings, we used to be very critical in our analysis and deliberations on individual countries, but at the same time, we were cautiously optimistic in our future predictions. We perceived building democracy as a work in progress. We were convinced that the will of Central Eastern European countries, both governments and the publics, and the related EU conditionality provides a strong formative tool in shaping politics and the state of democracy in aspirant countries, that a perspective of NATO membership is a powerful incentive for political elites to commit themselves to democratization. We incline to believe that at least in some countries, civil society actors can significantly and positively influence political process towards the strengthening of substantial features of democracy. And we were right. Subsequent developments in Baltic countries, at that time, you might recall, the Latvians had problems with the Russian minorities and several other problems. But the developments in the Baltics, in Bulgaria and Romania, and in a symptomatic way in Slovakia, have confirmed our expectations. Slovakia not only proved to be a showcase how the trends towards illiberalism may be reversed through free elections, but its public mobilization appeal, combined with broad cooperation of various players, joined as informal alliance for democracy, by the way, inspired also by some experiences in Latin America, where we were witnessing those pro-democratic coalitions consisting of different actors. So all that has appeared to be inspirative for what Valerie Bunce and Sharon Volchik called electoral revolutions in the following decade. Let me add a couple of words about Slovakia, where the actors of civil society, thanks to their OK98 civic campaign in 1998, contributed to the defeat of Vladimir Mečiar's semi-authoritarian rule by helping to guarantee a fair course of elections, and especially by mobilizing the electorate, attracting over 48% of eligible voters, especially young and first-time voters at that time. I think the important factor in the following years after the elections was that the civic voice has not disappeared from the public domain. Some of the NGOs have entered into cooperative partnership with the new government. The others have continued to deliver social, charitable, healthcare, environmental, educational, culture, and community-based services and public goods, often functioning as complementary groupings to the state institutions. Still others have continued in their mission of social innovators. Several of them have been active in combating racism, preserving diversity and plurality of lifestyles, promoting tolerance towards minorities, designing and implementing various programs to improve the situation of disadvantaged groups. And Slovak watchdogs, advocacy organizations, human rights group, and public policy institutes have devoted their time, their potential, their energy to what they considered as their mission, to act as responsible citizens, controlling those in power, participating in the building of rule of law and of democratic governance, and critically reflecting urgent social, political, and economic problems. Between 1998 and 2002, a number of advocacy initiatives and campaigns were launched and implemented. Let me mention just one of them, perhaps the most important, which was the nationwide campaign launched in 2000 under the slogan, "What is not secret should be made public." And that was a campaign in favor of passing of a good law on Freedom of Information Act. More than 120 NGOs joined this program, more than 100,000 members were active in this, and the campaign achieved to set a goal largely due to the ability of Slovak NGOs again to form alliances and communicate with the general public. Then came another test for the third sector's maturity, parliamentary elections in 2002. Well, the post-election euphoria of 1998 was long gone, and Slovak citizens were disenchanted over the style of the government by politicians that had been brought to power, partly with the help from the third sector. These elections were not in so much about defending the foundations of democracy, but about the success of Slovakia's integration aspirations. And while a number of NGOs voiced doubts overtaking an active role before the elections, the concerns over possible strengthening position of radical and national populist parties, which could block the country's integration ambitions, have encouraged at least a part of NGOs to launch campaigns. The key concept for these elections was to increase informed participation in elections. Therefore, priority was given to various information, education, and motivation activities. In 1998, the turnout was 84%. In 2002, the voter participation reached 70% and would have been even lower had it not been for activities pursued by NGOs, and most probably another government, not that of Mikuláš Zurinda, would be elected. And this hypothesis, and that's why I'm mentioning it, was indirectly corroborated by the 56 voter turnout in the June 2006 parliamentary elections when Slovak NGOs didn't campaign at all. For different reasons, they have resigned on their possible participation and haven't been present in the campaign as the sources of mobilization, motivation, or information. And not only the turnout decreased to less than 56%, but their absence has opened a greater space for social and national populism. Skepticism towards politics, distrust to political parties, widespread suspicion of corruption, but also the non-existence of the feeling of urgency, all that has played a certain role. And today, the NGOs right now in these days are struggling with the new government, which is rather insensitive to civil society needs, and they are launching a bit lately a new campaign advocating their right to sustain and serve. Obviously, the above mentioned disengagement of the NGOs in the electoral process is only a part of explanation of the recent developments. By and large, we have been witnessing somewhat what might be called a post-accession hangover, a big story of enlargement, with all the efforts put in and certain political correctness performed by the players was over, so that the countries could now show their true face. Beyond and down, experiences of social injustice and inequality, which resulted in the division between the losers and the winners of the transition, have also played a role. In Poland, says Jacek Kucharczyk, the losers wanted their share of the cake, and thus they elected a parliamentary majority and the president who promised more solidarity and less liberalism in public policy. In Slovakia, huge regional differences, for instance, have created an impression of the arrogance of the government operating in Bratislava, the capital located in western Slovakia, with the per capita GDP equaling the EU average and unemployment under 4%, in sharp contrast with the levels around 25 or 30% in Eastern Slovakia. Another important factor was the level of corruption, both real and perceived one. In Poland, the political left was divided and its credibility was seriously damaged by corruption scandals. In some other cases, the media coverage of the related issues was much greater than in the past, and the efforts to change the legislature, to implement anti-corruption measures, and to expose the political and economic system to higher transparency has appeared to be politically counterproductive for the power holders, as the opposition has used anti-corruption rhetoric as a powerful and efficient political instrument. Well, not only corruption issues were used by the opposition, but also other items from the typical populist package brought to the political arena by populist parties. Monopolies striving only for their profits, increasing the price of gas and electricity and not paying enough to local workers, the whole issue of immigration, distrust towards the work of judges and judiciary system, the calls for law and order and for tougher measures against crime, a deepening gap between us and them, doubts about democracy as the best political system. Some political parties and groupings quite openly went nationalistic. Slovak National Party, for instance, in Slovakia had the only agenda to prevent the ethnic Hungarians to continue in the third term in the government. Huge billboards all over the Slovakia were appealing Slovaks vote for a Slovak government. In Bulgaria, even the name of the radical nationalist party speaks for volumes. It is called ATAK. In Hungary, during the last unrest, some of the protesters, many of them without realizing it, were waving the so-called Árpád flags, which were sadly misused during the fascist period of the end of Second World War in Hungary. And also, finally, my thesis and someone who was involved for 12 years in psychotherapy is that those years have created an incredible mental burden for the population. The amount of changes was really very, very huge. And to adapt to all that, it required a lot from the population. At least definitely in Slovakia, those requirements and those demands were perceived and were experienced as a heavy burden. Now, let me stop for a moment and allow me a short digression, a detour, if you like. We should perhaps be cautious before we use the term populism, and we have good reasons for it. It's not for the first time that we are witnessing resurgence of populism. Populism has a long history in several countries, several continents. If we put aside the pre-Second World War history, which for the obvious reasons is the most disturbing, we have also more recent examples. We can call a shocking success in the Polish presidential election in the 90s of a previously unknown candidate, Timiński. I don't know if some of the Poles who are in the audience even recall this name. And we also remember the success of the party of former king in Bulgaria some years ago. In Slovakia, both elections, 1998 and 2002, two different newly established parties have made it into the parliament, and practically they were running on an agenda which might be labeled as a centrist populist agenda. And in these elections, one such a party has almost made it. By the way, if it happened, we might have another situation in Slovakia. Television obviously has had much to do with this trend, creating a popular culture that demands new heroes and miraculous solutions. But if there is a thread that links the growing caste of alternative politicians, it is populism. In contemporary Germany, similar concerns over the well-being of the middle class push the Christian Democrats, CDU, and the conservatives more towards the statist position in the economy, knowing very well that they are threatened by the Free Democrats, whose boss, Franny Mintenfang, called foreign investors locusts. Or take the recent developments and elections in Netherlands, where the Liberal Party advocating tougher immigration policies lost at the expense of newly formed Freedom Party campaigning for closing borders all to all non-Western immigrants, as well as the Socialist Party, combining isolationism, nationalism, and leftist populism. And I'm sure at least some people in this room still remember a man who was presenting himself as a blunt, no-nonsense businessman, blaming the mess in Washington on corrupt politicians and foreign lobbyists, and promising, if elected, to consult the people on major issues by means of televised town hall meetings, campaigning against NAFTA after the elections in alliance with labor unions, playing on the fears of millions of Americans that they would lose their jobs to Mexicans, whom he described as living in slums and working for starvation wages. And in that time, it was not only Ross Perot, whom I just quoted, it was also, if we stay on this continent, the newly established Canadian right-wing Reform Party, which, like Ross Perot, also got 19% of total vote, following a populist script by promising magical economic results, utilizing concerns of Canadians about immigrants taking jobs and offering drastic changes in the parliamentary system. All moving southwards, a remarkable example of populism in action occurred in Peru, where two alternative politicians opposed each other in, I think, 1990 elections. Mario Vargas Llosa, a famous public intellectual and writer, who was actually leading the polls for quite a long time, but then he was challenged by another political outsider, Alberto Fujimori, an agriculture engineer, host of television show, campaigned under the vague promise of work, technology, and honesty. And he argued that Llosa's proposed policy of orthodox economic reform would be hard on poor people, and his message was carried out into the country's police communication. The strategy was successful, only that after 2 years in office, Fujimori assumed authoritarian powers, and we all remember how he has ended. But to conclude this part, why to return into the distant past? In the recent midterm elections, we saw the candidates winning on protectionist topics, on criticism, not only on big businesses, but also on free trade. And business bashing and protectionism combined with criticism of the hubris of American elites was a part of agenda. And if we are watching a surprising reincarnation of CNN anchor Lou Dobbs from an expert on money to a champion of little guy, an advocate of the middle class betrayed by the elites, opposing to big corporation, supporting minimum wage, and at the same time being tough of new immigration on the UN, opposing gun control, defending economic nationalism. So we see that the examples of populism are not isolated only in Central and Eastern Europe. Let us move for a moment to the demonstrations and consequences of those new trends. While it is still probably premature to assess it, to make a final judgment, some of its features are really problematic. And I really do not envy my former colleagues, diplomats, serving for the countries where they have to address different audiences to explain what is actually the situation in their countries and to explain why their governments created strange coalitions and everything what is connected with it. I think rise of the populism and its stronger saying in some elected representation has serious impacts both on real politics as well as on political culture. If we speak about real politics, there are elements of majoritarianism in political behavior. For instance, there were some unwritten rules how the composition of parliamentary committees and chairmanships were established. There were committees which usually were offered to the opposition, like the Foreign Policy Committee, Committee for Overseeing Intelligence Services, and so on. We do not see it now in the Slovak parliament. What follows also is an evident tendency, not only in Slovakia, towards monopolization of power. In Slovakia, for instance, the leading party at this time has in its hands quite an impressive amount of important political positions. They have prime minister, they have 11 ministers, 13 state secretaries, they have the bosses of all important departments which are connected with big money, finance, economy, defense. They nominated the head of the Secret Service, and there is a long list of the important institutions, economic or regulatory ones, with new directors appointed and all controlled by this party. Our president was elected as an opposition candidate supported by this party called Smer. And what is even more disturbing is that as of January 2007, the tenure of 7 of the 13 judges of the Constitutional Court is scheduled to end, and the new candidates, among them some completely unknown or problematic personalities, were elected by the parliament majority, which is now firmly in the hands of the current ruling coalition, and now the president will select half of them to serve in Constitutional Court. And I could go on with the attempts to influence the selection of the new director of public TV and so on. We have been witnessing, for instance, in the field of the foreign service, the purges in Poland, and there are many other examples of this tendency towards monopolization of power. But maybe even more important, because this might change after the next elections, is some changes, both subtle and more visible, in the political style, in political culture. We see some elements of political radicalism. This is a tradition in Slovakia. Let me remind you of a fascinating essay of Slovak historian Lubomir Liptak, who spoke of some typical tendencies in Slovakia's politics in the past. And one of them was a characteristic, emblematic political radicalism, which he called Janošikovstvo, according to the well-known robber, usually connected with the conviction that there is a simple, quick, revolutionary solution for the basic economic and social problems of Slovak society. Usually the radical propaganda was offering, I'm quoting, a practical solution on the base of ethnic, religious, racial, or class criteria. A specific group of population was always designed as enemies of the state, nation, the working people, or religion. And it was usually connected with the transfer of property from those unfriendly elements. And this procedure was presented as a recipe, as a formula, as a blueprint for solving social problems. And indeed, if we look at the rhetoric of the Smer party in the pre-election year, we could see economic monopolies, international corporations, and commercial banks as the axis of evil. One might argue this was just a sheer rhetoric to attract the voters, and in reality, most of those ideas will be never implemented because pragmatism prevails. But even after the elections, Slovak Prime Minister Mr. Fico has shown certain inclinations towards conspiracy interpretation. Then another important element is low sensitiveness towards the foreign policy opinion. For instance, the membership of Smer in the socialist grouping, Socialist International, was challenged, but they didn't seem to care about it. What is especially disturbing is a change language, change tolerance towards what is acceptable, change style of the discussion in public debate. In Poland, it is intolerance against the gay and lesbians. In Slovakia, a change tolerance towards what is acceptable and what is not. The chairman of the Slovak National Party, in an interview with the Czech paper, said that he envies the Czechs who were able to get rid of the Germans after the Second World War, with a clear hint towards Hungarians. And a week ago, the candidate and the person who was nominated by the Slovak National Party as the new head or new chair of the Institute of National Memory, certainly Mr. Tarnoci, who was criticized by representatives of Jewish communities for his problematic behavior in somehow coming back to Slovak past and being very friendly to the problematic figures of this period. He said, well, the Jews are only 0.1 promile, who cares? So, I mean, this is the language which is used. I mentioned the Prime Minister's Gyurcsány's statement. While some people have even praised him for simply telling what is generally known, but what hasn't been until recently spoken as openly, at the same time, what is very problematic, he has established a lie as acceptable truth in politics. So it means we have been campaigning like this, but we knew this is not true. Another problematic element is suspicion towards media. In Poland, attacks against so-called liberal media, but also not only against media, but also against independent central bank. And in several cases, also some attacks towards or against European Union. One last remark in this part. We are not talking about the situation and the atmosphere which was resemble to the pre-Second World War period. These are not Weimar times. And if not for anything else, then at least because the economy is prospering very well in these countries, both in Poland and in Slovakia and in the Czech Republic, and also to a certain extent in Bulgaria, Hungary for a period of time might be an exception. So it means economy, not only it is the national economies, not only that they are in a good shape, but they will be even encouraged in their performance by incredible amount of European money. In Poland, it's 93 billion, in Slovakia, 11 billion of euros. So it means both in Poland and in Slovakia especially, the government is quite popular. It is enjoying popular support because it has all the tools for redistributing. There is a question why we should be concerned. And let me mention two special aspects why I think that it's worrisome. The first is, the certain iconography, certain image of Central Europe, which has been anchored in American and the Western mind. And the second is the experience, a more positive experience, that of Visegrad cooperation. To simplify, I think we can talk about three concepts of Central European identity present in American mind. The first, obviously, is the heroic mirror. It holds a longer tradition and has not always been connected with Central Europe as a territory, but with a personality, statesmen and the leaders who have led the fight against oppression. Monumental figures like Kosciuszko and Pulaski and Kossuth, later on also Masaryk, who has his monument in Washington, and we could go on and on. Those were the freedom fighters of their times, and in the more recent era, their role was played by the